Blog Talk Radio.
People, how's everybody doing? Got a great show. We have President Obama releasing his executive order on gun reform. I'm going to break that down for you. I'm going to give you the provisions that we know of. Then I have Jeb Bush trying to rehabilitate his campaign, and naturally, in order to do that, he has to go to the liberal network, MSNBC, because they're oh so liberal. And he goes on the circle jerk of the establishment, Morning Joe, where they yuck it up and do some fake laughs and act like that's going to help Jeb rehabilitate his campaign when, of course, it's not. But there's a lot to take away from that, including Jeb Bush's new strategy, which he touches on in that interview. It's only the saddest political strategy you've ever heard in your life. I mean, he's already run a very sad campaign. You know, you wouldn't be wrong for thinking, I don't know how this could get worse. It somehow got worse, so we'll discuss that. And then later on in the show, Marco Rubio gets more hawkish. I don't know how that's possible either, but somehow he does. Bill O'Reilly versus Donald Trump. Randomly, Bill O'Reilly decided, hey, let me actually ask some decent questions here. And, God, it's going to get super creepy and weird and awkward and strange later on in the show when we get to Ben Carson and his interview with CNN. And, I mean, the shit that you have to say to try to appease the right-wing base, I mean, this guy, he starts running full speed towards the dumbest parts of the Bible and Christian ideology because he thinks that's going to help him save his campaign. And we didn't get to it yesterday, but I got to try to squeeze it into today's show. President Erdogan of Sweet Jesus, man. The stuff that he says and the stuff that he does, it's unbelievable. I've said it so many times in private conversations and elsewhere, but this is the kind of dumbass that blunders his way into World War III. It's a guy like Erdogan that starts World War III and doesn't even realize that he did it. And a good example of that was shooting down the Russian plane when there was no reason to shoot down the Russian plane. Now, thankfully, there was some restraint on the part of Russia, but Turkey's a NATO ally, man. I believe they're one of the biggest armies in NATO. So you shoot down a Russian plane, and it's a Russia versus NATO standoff. That drags the U.S. in, and boom, we're in World War III. Wait till you hear what he said recently. Okay, so I want to kick it off here, and we'll do that with the gun reform. I have some more details about President Obama's executive order that I want to share with you guys. We have some details on President Obama's executive gun reform. The Trace is reporting the following, quote, a fact sheet circulated by the White House sketched out the package. It includes a plan for the FBI to increase the number of federal gun background check examiners and staff by 50%. So that's the first thing here. They say a proposal to hire an additional 200 federal agents and investigators to focus on gun offenses and regulations. That's thing number two. Then we have a directive to the Department of Justice, Defense, and Homeland Security to develop research agendas for firearm safety and possible procurement strategies for smart guns. There's going to be a push to ensure that persons, quote, engaged in the business of selling firearms register as licensed dealers. So that's thing number four, and this is the general breakdown of the provisions of his executive action on gun reform. Now, there's a reason why I'm not calling it an executive order. I'm going to get to that in a second here. But as of right now, gun sellers fall into two separate categories. So you have federal firearms licensees or FFLs as they're called, and private sellers. And FFLs are regulated by the ATF, and they conduct background checks. Now, in 32 states, though, private sellers don't do background checks. So the idea is to get more private sellers who are really big dealers to actually register with the ATF so we can do more background checks. Now, as far as the legality of this, because some people are going to say, well, are we sure that all this is constitutional? We know that all spending bills have to originate in Congress. If they're spending on this and it doesn't originate in Congress, that would be unconstitutional. But they explain here, quote, Obama's new executive actions on background checks do not approach the level of an order. So this isn't an executive order. It's an executive action, which isn't as legally binding. They say rather than a hard and fast regulatory change, which can take longer to develop than Obama has left in his presidency, they represent less formal guidelines that the ATF will implement for gun dealing, which means that Obama may wind up facing criticism not just from those who he's overstepped, but those who could conclude he has not gone far enough. So what they're saying here is there's going to be some real criticism from the left of all places, because the left is going to say, that's all you did? That's it? Now, the American Constitutional Society porched this move. And if you ask me, my take on it is that it's a step in the right direction. I mean, it's not good enough in terms of what we need to do for the country on the issue of gun reform. But I think constitutionally, it might be all that he can do on his own. And unlike the Republicans, I'm actually consistent in my belief that we should abide by the Constitution and we should stay within the legal framework that we have. So I'm not in favor of unitary executive action overriding the way that the system is supposed to function, because once you set that precedent, then Republican presidents can do the same in the opposite direction. And they can say, I'm just going to override federal gun laws and I'm going to make them weaker when they're in office. So I actually believe in the Constitution and believe that you have to stay within the boundaries. And the sense I get from this is that President Obama thought, hey, this is all that I could do on this issue to stay within the Constitution, so this is what I'm going to do. Now, in other areas, as we know, the Bush administration and the Obama administration are like, Constitution, smonstitution. Whether it's, you know, us bombing in Syria and being involved in Syria militarily when you need a formal declaration of war from Congress in order to do that, and we've been there for over a year and we have no declaration of war, so that's wildly unconstitutional. But the right wants him there anyway, too, so it's like everybody just silently agrees to do this unconstitutional thing. Or whether it's the NSA and the spying programs and how that basically ignores the Fourth Amendment completely. So in many ways, he does act in an unconstitutional way. I'm against it when he does it there. I would be against it here. If he actually went too far with his executive orders on gun reform, I would be against it here too. But that's the thing. These aren't even executive orders. They're executive actions which aren't as legally binding. So in other words, it's like they're just going to come up with guidelines that they hope people will abide by more since they laid them out. Kind of weak, but again, it might be all that he could do with just the executive branch without going to Congress. And I guess, by the way, the way that he's going to fund this stuff is simply by reallocating money that they already get, okay? Because, you know, like I said, if you're doing something that requires spending, that has to originate in Congress. That's the way that our system of government is set up. So for him to try to do, I'll repeat it here, it includes a plan for the FBI to increase the number of federal gun background check examiners and staff by 50%. So for him to try to increase that staff, they're going to need to, you know, reallocate funds. And for them to try to hire an additional 200 federal agents and investigators to focus on gun regulations, they're going to need to do that as well. And even for the other stuff. So where they try to do research now for firearm safety so we get more data, so then hopefully we can take more action since we have more data, although Congress has shown they're not very good with data. But overall, I support this. Now, in terms of what I would do. So they say that he didn't even close the gun show loophole. He just was shrinking it. So in terms of what I would do, this is an area where I agree with his executive action, and it might be all that he could do within the confines of the Constitution. But it, through Congress, what I would try to do, and I would push hard, and I would be aggressive, and I would go on the offense, and I would make it a campaign issue, and I would hammer them with it, what I would try to do is call out the Republicans for, very simply just not caring about this issue and what the American people think about it. And why is that? Because they're corrupt, because they take money from the gun lobby. Now, the problem isn't even the members of the NRA, the people. They're fine. They're regular people. 75% of them want universal background checks. The problem is the leadership of the NRA, who take their money from people who make money from selling guns. So there's this unholy alliance where the gun manufacturers and the gun sellers control policy in Congress on guns. Talk about the fox guarding the hen house there. So you have this unholy alliance. There's massive corruption to not get any more gun rules. So I would use this as a campaign issue. The Democrats, broadly speaking, do not take money from the NRA. Maybe there's a few here or there, but most of them do not. So I would say, hey, these guys are corrupt. Look at what they're doing. Hey, 90% of the American people want a universal background check for gun sales. We haven't gotten it. They blocked it. Why are they dictators? Why are they fascists? Why are they tyrants? Why do they hate the American people? Why do they not care what you think? Why are they okay with your kids dying? This is how you play politics, and this is how you win. And I would try to get a massive gun buyback program and give people an offer they can't refuse so we chip away at the 300 million guns in circulation. Now, I wouldn't do gun confiscation because I actually don't think that's constitutional, and I think that that goes too far in the other direction. But I would do a massive gun buyback program to limit the number of guns in the U.S. I would do universal background checks. I would limit high-capacity magazines. I would ban certain kinds of assault weapons. And I would implement some kind of permit system. You know, like if you're a game warden, I get it. You need guns. Great. Well, there's a permit system. You go through it. Boom. You can have your guns. But if you're in a city, if you're in a highly densely populated area, that's just different than rural Montana. You can pretend that's not the case, but it is the case. Okay, so you have to set up a kind of tiered permit system that makes it rational and sane. I mean, the idea that you need, all these different forms of verification and this test in order to drive a car, but then for something that's only made to kill and practice killing, well, you just go buy that on a Tuesday before brunch if you're a paranoid schizophrenic and you got three felonies in your background. That's fucking crazy. That's fucking crazy. Okay, so, again, this is only going to shrink the gun show loophole. That's probably the biggest problem we have. 40% of gun purchases in the U.S. have no background check associated with them whatsoever. Go to a gun show and they just sell it to you. No background check at all. So 40%. So let's say Obama's executive action, I don't know, let's be kind to him. Say, you know, he cuts it 50% from there. Well, that's not enough. We got to close that and we got to get it done the right way. I understand that you can't necessarily do it through executive orders or executive actions. So you have to play politics right to get the right policy. And what the Democrats don't understand is that this is actually an opportunity for them to thrive and for them to win in the next election cycle. If you just message properly and market properly, because this is an issue where everybody's with you in the American public. So use that to your advantage and get majorities in the next election, and then you could actually, you know, get this passed through Congress the right way. Okay. Next. Let's go to Jeb Bush's campaign. And just how poorly that's going. As if I even need to say that. I think everybody knows. Even his mom. His mom told him beforehand, I don't think we need another Bush president. Couldn't agree with you more, Mrs. Bush. Jeb Bush is continuing to try and rehabilitate his dead campaign. He went on Morning Joe to yuck it up and make some pre-planned jokes here. So let's watch the awkwardness in all of its glory.
Important to stop Donald Trump. You said you're a lonely voice and speaking out against him, and you said your brother's popular. Would you like the 43rd president of the United States to speak out against Donald Trump publicly, as you are?
That's a good question.
I think that's my job. You got to take on the bully head on, and that's what I'm doing. Everybody else is in the witness protection program, I've noticed, but look, you got to stand up for a guy. When he says the things he says and guarantees that a conservative is not going to be elected president,
Wrong. See, that's
I've been a conservative all my adult life, and that's what I'm fighting for, is to make sure the conservative cause is allowed to actually govern, and when we do, great things will happen for our country.
That's the jab I've known for 20 years.
Yeah.
Everybody's in the witness protection program.
That's so funny. Come on. You know that was planned. You know that was fake. I've never seen more forced laughter in my entire life. But this is what his campaign has become. Like, having conversations with conservative hosts behind the scenes. Like, okay, I'm going to make this joke about how all the other Republican candidates are in the witness protection program, and I'm the only bold one to stand up to Trump. You guys are going to laugh, right? Right? Like, that wasn't even really a joke, either. Like, it's a way of saying, hey, the other people aren't attacking Trump all that much, and I'm the only one doing it. Okay. They're in the witness protection program. You get it? They want to attack Trump? They're in the witness protection program? That's the Jeb Bush I've known. That's the one I've known. Yeah, that's the one we all know, which is why he's at -27% in the polls. Nobody's interested in that. Nobody. It's so awkward. It's so awkward. And the new strategy is actually to bring out George W. Bush because, quote, he goes on to say this. He is very popular. What? He's very popular. Only in Republican land can you say shit like that and everybody's like, yeah, right, go on. He's very popular, and I also know I need to go earn this. My brother has been a strong supporter, and I love him dearly. He'll continue to play a constructive role in his campaign. Okay. He's doing so poorly that he wants one of the worst presidents in U.S. history, certainly one of the worst presidents in modern times, to campaign for him. I rest my case against the Republican Party. I mean, I think I've done that a long time ago. So we're just coasting here. But seriously, that's your idea is to go to George W. Bush. George W. Bush was a miserable failure, even on all of the fronts that Republicans say they care about. So, for example, when it comes to the deficit, this one thing where they always say, Obama, oh my God, deficit, tax and spend liberals, blow up the budget. You know how they are. Am I right? Am I right? No, actually, you're wrong. It was Reagan who had a record debt and deficit. It was H.W. Bush who had a record debt and deficit. By the way, who balanced the annual deficit and left us with a surplus? Bill Clinton, Democrat. And there have been many things he did wrong, but on this front, okay, he did what you guys say you like. George W. Bush left us with a $1.4 trillion deficit. What's Obama done with that? He took it down to about $400 billion, cut it tremendously. So, you know, even according to what you guys care about, the deficit, jobs. George Bush net lost 646,000 private sector jobs when he was president. Private sector, so this is capitalism. You know what Republicans say they care about? The only area he grew jobs? Public sector. That's socialism. Grow government jobs. So he ballooned government jobs. Republicans say they hate that. He lost private sector jobs. Republicans hate that. And Jeb's like, this guy's still more popular than me. Perhaps it's because I make jokes that don't make much sense and that you guys fake laugh at. No, it can't be that. Let's blame Trump. And then never mind the wars, too. You know, you put the wars on the credit card and attack the wrong country. Just stop. And this is who they go to. Let's go to that guy. Let's go to the war criminal. We're doing so poorly in the polls. We got to try to get a war criminal to campaign for us. Why don't you take Idi Amin's grave out of the body, body out of the grave, and use him. Prop up his carcass to campaign for you. See how that works out. All right, now, speaking of war, time to go to Marco Rubio and expose this clown for what he is. The Guardian has some... The Guardian has a great article on Marco Rubio, where Rubio has some bombastic ideas on foreign policy. So Rubio was at an event in New Hampshire, and he went after Hillary Clinton and other Republicans. He said this, quote, "We have Republican candidates who propose that rulers like Assad and Putin should be partners of the United States, and who have voted with Barack Obama and Harry Reid than with the men and women in uniform. We have isolationist candidates who are apparently more passionate about weakening our military and intelligence capabilities than about destroying our enemies." He continues, "One of the things that hurt Saudi Arabia has been this president's betrayal of our allies in favor of Iran with this deal. The other thing is the situation with Saudi Arabia reveals the true nature of the criminal government that governs Iran. They allowed protesters to storm a diplomatic facility." Okay, there's so much to say about this. I don't know how he managed to fit so many stupid comments in such a tiny space. But first, okay, Saudi Arabia. As he's talking about Saudi Arabia, he can't help but only bring up the crimes of Iran. Meanwhile, Saudi Arabia is our ally. They just beheaded 47 people in accordance with Sharia law. In Saudi Arabia, they behead people for apostasy. They behead people for drug smuggling. They behead people for sorcery and witchcraft. And what does this jackass say? "Oh my God, Saudi! It's hurt Saudi that we've betrayed them." Betrayed them? So why do you want to be buddy-buddy with a country that acts like this? Why do you want to be buddy-buddy with the Salafi terror state? Just say it. I'm an establishment prick. It's all about the business connections. It's all about the oil. It's all about corporate hegemony. I'm a puppet of corporate America, so they want to maintain a close relationship, so I'm with them to maintain a close relationship. Humanitarianism, altruism, caring about human rights, fuck that. What are you, some kind of liberal pussy? We make deals with terror states because it's convenient. What don't you get? As we pretend that we care about morality when it comes to Iran. Oh, Iran, you're so immoral. But we just said Saudi Arabia is even more extreme than Iran. Nothing. They're like, oh, don't talk about them. They're our buddy. We like them. Iran, bad, bad, bad. Oh, look at this criminal government. The true nature of the criminal government. The people that beheaded 47 people, including activists, who governed by a far-right Sharia law and a strict interpretation of Islam. No, they're cool. They're cool. All right, so there's first comical point. And then also, he loves to bring up isolationist. Of course, he's talking about Rand Paul, and he likes to lump Ted Cruz in that category, even though I don't think it's true that Ted Cruz is in that category, or Rand Paul even, because what he doesn't get is isolationist, of course, has a negative connotation to it, and it also has an implication of, hey, even on economic issues, they're going to isolate us from the world, and they don't want to deal with anybody for any reason whatsoever, even diplomatically, yada, yada. No, the real term for what Rand Paul is non-interventionist-ish, because I'm not even sure he's a committed non-interventionist. And what that means is, hey, we should probably only use our military and fight wars, you know, for, like, self-defense. See, that's a position that used to be called common sense, and now it's like, oh, radical! This guy doesn't even want to start wars in multiple countries at once when they didn't attack us. What a loser. No, Marco, perhaps you're the loser. And then also, he said, the point at the beginning is just beyond stupid. Now, if you don't know a lot about politics, you might read this and go, ooh, he makes a decent point there when he says, we have Republican candidates who propose that rulers like Assad and Putin should be partners of the United States. A lot of people hear that and be like, oh, yeah, that's not right. Putin's a bad guy. Assad's a bad guy. What are we doing? What is he not telling you? We would only be allies with them for one specific issue, fighting ISIS, fighting jihadists. It's not like even the other Republican candidates, like Ted Cruz, are like, well, gosh golly, Putin sure is a great guy, isn't he? No, they're saying, hey, at least they're fighting the jihadists and Islamists in Syria. Why would we not be with them on that front? I mean, to be against them on this issue is like saying, like, you know, making the argument that Hitler liked dogs. You like dogs. You're like Hitler. No, but that's the thing that stupid people say. I guess you like Assad and Putin. No, you don't like Assad and Putin. The only thing you agree with them on is that they're fucking fighting ISIS. It's just all of his arguments are so disingenuous. He's not even done yet. He says they allowed them, talking about Iran, to storm a wing or section of the Saudi embassy and trash it. And it just gives you an indication of who we're dealing with here. This is a country that has no respect for international laws, has no respect for norms of governance. Again, irony, irony, irony. Look, nobody denies that Iran is, terrible in many ways, and they are criminal in many ways. And this point isn't even necessarily wrong when you're talking about them. The only issue is he doesn't say it about Saudi, and it's true about Saudi, but he wants to protect Saudi at all costs because they're our buddy. So he only applies moral standards to the governments that he's already decided are our enemies. Dare he apply them to us? Dare he apply them to Saudi? Never. By the way, in the same speech here in New Hampshire, he goes on to say, we should send more people to Guantanamo Bay. We should hold more people extrajudicially. We should do more NSA spying. But wait, Marco, you're not making sense. You can't say, like, criminal government disregarding international law when talking about Iran, and then in the next breath, you advocate the U.S. violates international law and our own laws. You just advocated for violating the Constitution. Let's do more NSA spying. Let's take away more privacy rights. Let's take away more protection from unreasonable search and seizure. So you're the thing that you say you hate. Look, criminal government, they're not like us. We're really moral, and we abide by the law when we hold people in an extrajudicial prison with no trial and no way out. And by the way, most of those people were totally innocent. We've told the story of how the people got to Guantanamo Bay. You had the Bush administration made a deal with the government in Pakistan and Afghanistan, and they sent us people who they said were jihadists and Al-Qaeda. Come to find out, they just rounded up people they didn't like, people who were against their governments, regardless of the fact that they were jihadists or not. Many of them were not, and they just sent them to us and said, yeah, that's Al-Qaeda. And we locked them up, tortured them, everything. And 20% of the people we tortured, totally innocent. There are people who died who were innocent that we killed with stuff like hypothermia torture. And what does Marco Rubio say? Oh, yes, let's do that. Iran, criminal government. But you're advocating for the shit that's also criminal. Doesn't count when we do it. Doesn't count when we do it. So the final thing I want to say about this is he's horrible on policy for all the reasons I just laid out for you. But he's also horrible on strategy. This is what he doesn't get. Marco Rubio actually has a good chance of getting the nomination. Why do I say that? Because he's the establishment fallback candidate. And typically the establishment fallback candidate always does better than you think they're going to do. So with John McCain, for example, he was the establishment fallback candidate. He got the nomination. Nobody was saying, oh, it's going to be him. Everybody's like, hold the nose, the Republican-based voters. He's too moderate, yada, yada. They ended up voting for him. Mitt Romney, establishment fallback candidate. Thurston Howell III, robot-like creature, Mitt Romney, ended up getting the nomination. Why? The Republican base had their fun. Oh, Gingrich. Oh, Herman Cain. Oh, Rick Santorum at the end of the day. Nothing for them. Okay, we got to go for Mitt Romney. The establishment fallback. Rubio is that now. Okay, he's got all the money from the big money interests and the corporations and the establishment that always helps people get their message out and their name out more. So he's got the big money people with him, and he's safe. He's safe like McCain, like Romney. Okay, he's fake, he's a politician. Maybe he'll get us to win the general. Okay, let's go for him. He has a good chance of winning as a result of that, but he's fucking it up. Why? The candidate of war and violence always loses. Always loses. You go back, even George W. Bush when he was running, you think he said to the world, hey, I'm going to start wars all over the place and be an imperialist? No, he didn't. He ran as a compassionate conservative. He was like, I care about peace. So people voted for him. Fucking Barry Goldwater was portrayed as the guy who's going to drop a nuke because he kind of alluded to the fact that he would be aggressive and he would start wars. What happened? He got blown out. Across the board, the candidate of war always loses, but Marco Rubio thinks, because he's so far up his own ass and up the Republican Party's ass, I got to do it because we're tough and strong on national defense, but you don't win that way. So not only is it stupid from a policy perspective, it's stupid from a politics perspective, and he's shooting himself in the foot if he keeps making arguments like this. But then again, I should be in favor of that because I certainly don't want Marco Rubio winning, but I also don't want anybody on the Republican side winning. All right. Fuck, I got to take a quick break. Don't want to, but I have to. When I come back, we'll get to Bill O'Reilly going after Donald Trump, which is interesting. And then Fox News is going to go into defense mode over the armed right-wing Patriot group, so-called Patriot group, that took over that government building in Oregon. Stay right there. Donald Trump, unsurprisingly. Bill O'Reilly randomly decided to be a tough journalist and ask Trump some real questions about the Middle East, and naturally, Trump's answers were atrocious.
If you're elected president, are you going to take military action against Iran? Are you going to do something to that country?
Well, I would want to help Saudi Arabia. I would want to protect Saudi Arabia, but Saudi Arabia is going to have to help us economically. They were making, before the oil went down, now they're making half, but they were making $1 billion
a day. Yeah, but you dodged my question. Would you take action against Iran militarily if you're president?
Depending on what the deal is, I would have to do that. I would defend certain groups of people over there. The deal we made with Iran is a disaster.
Okay.
The deal we made for $150 billion is a total disaster.
So you would revoke
and you know that,
that
Iran's going to have a nuclear weapon very soon. Bill, Iran is going to have a nuclear weapon very soon.
Okay, first of all, no, that's not true. The whole point of the deal was the opposite of that. The whole purpose of the deal was, okay, you don't get a nuke, and we release some economic sanctions against you and give you back some of your own money. Trump goes on to say, we're giving them billions of dollars. That's unbelievable. He doesn't go on to tell you, though, that's billions of dollars of their own money. So we're giving them back their own money. And the promise in return is we're not going to create a nuke, and the IAEA has the right to go in there virtually whenever they want in order to see if they're making a nuke, and they do regular inspections. So seems like a fair trade-off to me, but he just lies and makes it up like almost everybody else in the Republican Party does, and that's literal, by the way. We say, oh, yeah, Iran's getting a nuke. Obama just made it so Iran is getting a nuke. So in the twilight zone of Republicanville, they just managed to flip the truth on its head, and everybody repeats it over and over. Yeah, Obama, the Iranians getting a nuke, Iranians getting a nuke, even though the deal is the exact opposite of that. Okay, so that's the first thing. But the more important point here is, did you see what he said at the beginning? He said, quote, I would have to do that. Depending on the situation, I would have to do that. I would have to go to war with Iran to help and protect Saudi Arabia. So this is what we've come to. And actually, believe it or not, first and last time I'll ever say this, credit to Bill O'Reilly here because he goes on to press him on this. And he's like, wait, are you really saying you would send brave young American men and women to die in a war to protect a Salafi terror state? He doesn't use those words. I'm using those words. But that's more or less the gist of what he asked in the follow-up. He's like, are you saying you would let the U.S. military act like a mercenary army where we go and we fight wars with for other people? And Trump's like, yeah, I mean, I'd have to see, depending on the situation, I would have to do that. Oh, no. And this is why somebody like Bernie Sanders and somebody like Rand Paul on the issue of foreign policy, this is why the American people go, yeah, I'm with that person on that issue. Why? Because these are people who take the position that used to be called common sense, where you say, you know, hey, maybe we should be non-interventionist. And the idea behind that is we don't fuck with other people and do offensive wars. The only time we should do a war is in self-defense. And as I've said before, if there's a genocide going on somewhere and we know that one side is basically pure comic book style evil and the other side is totally innocent, sure, let the UN get involved and let's do it all together, not unilateral action, but everybody together. So you can do that and still say, I only want to use our military for self-defense. This is why they're surging. This is why, well, Rand Paul, anything but surging at the moment. But this is why on that particular policy issue, they have a lot of backing. Somebody like Bernie Sanders started at, you know, nothing, and without taking big money, he has, as a raw number, more supporters than Donald Trump does right now, and Trump is leading the Republican field. Now, with Bernie, it's a little more complicated because all the other issues he talks about, that needs to be weighed in as well because people are with him on virtually everything else as well. But non-interventionism is a very popular position around the U.S. If you look at polling data on each specific conflict, only 17% of us still want to be involved in Afghanistan, yet we're involved in Afghanistan under a Democratic administration. About the same number wanted to intervene in Syria, in the teens. So very few people want to do it, but nonetheless, Washington drags us all over the place. And here you have Donald Trump saying, yes, under a Trump presidency to help and protect the Saudis, I would have to do that. I would have to send our military to fight a war against Iran. What a terrible idea. And you do know that if you do that, the U.S. is aligning with, we are de facto allies with, the Sunnis in this broader Sunni-Shia war. And who else is on the side of the Sunnis? Let me think about this. ISIS? Al-Qaeda? All the different Wahhabi and Salafist groups? I know Donald Trump doesn't know dick about the Middle East, but Donald, I hate to tell you this, well over 80% of the terror attacks that are against the West from fundamentalist Muslims are from Sunni extremists, are from Salafists, are from Wahhabis. This is the ideology that the Saudi government represents. It ain't the Shias who are doing jihad at the moment. Okay, but he's like, yeah, I'd have to go and protect the people who are on the side of the people doing jihad. Let's go protect the people who are beheading people for sorcery and witchcraft and apostasy and drug smuggling. Let's protect them. Why? Because we care about democracy and freedom. That's the next thing. When they ramp up the propaganda to do the war against Iran, they say, oh, my human rights abuses. Oh, my God, we got to care about freedom and democracy. Go intervene. Yeah, but they don't tell you we would be intervening on behalf of the Saudis, who are the opposite of a free democratic regime. They are a pure aristocracy, and they run on Sharia law. There's no freedom there. They're a Sharia state. We have to go protect the Sharia state to stop the Sharia state. What? See, but that's the thing. It's not about humanitarianism and altruism and all this stuff. What it's really about is business. What it's really about is corporate hegemony and greed and imperialism and keeping the order the way it is around the world and the hierarchy the way it is, with America on top being the military might. That's what it's really about, and that's why Donald Trump is a profoundly scary person, because if he were to get elected, God knows what he would really do, because we know what his ego's like, and we know he's a buffoon, and we know he's liable to do anything. You really want to give that guy nukes? I'll let you make that decision, but there's a right and a wrong on this one. Okay, next. More foreign policy, and this gets really serious. Okay. Let me just check something here. Oops. I like how I do show maintenance while I'm in the middle of the show. That's always good. All right. There's a village of 40,000 people in Syria called Madaya, and Vice is reporting that Syrian forces and Hezbollah, who are aligned with the Syrian government, have been doing a crackdown there since July, and the effects are absolutely brutal. So they say the following, quote, in the past month alone, 31 residents have died from starvation or in attempts to run the Hezbollah manned blockade that encircles the town. 2 pounds of flour now retails for around $100, while the average Syrian makes less than $200 each month. People have resorted to literally eating leaves now to stay alive. They have pictures of this coming out of the area, and it's just absolutely gut-wrenching and heartbreaking to see that people in 2016 are living somewhere where they have so little food that they have to eat leaves just to try to stay alive. And you can see kids are basically bones, and old people and kids are really in danger of starving. So the idea apparently is that by doing this brutal blockade, you starve people into submission. And they allude to the fact that this is a medieval tactic. So Weiss continues here, quote, over the past 3 months, the Assad regime has prevented any additional shipments, essentially signing death warrants for dozens of children and elderly civilians in the coldest months of the winter. But there are also very practical reasons for the siege. Hezbollah is trying to trade the civilians in Medea for the well-being of Shiite civilians under siege by rebel forces in the northern cities of Kafraya and Fua. Though the siege undoubtedly takes a humanitarian toll, multiple residents in Medaya told Vice News that fighters with Arar al-Sham are present in the town. The group fights with al-Qaeda in the north of Syria. Okay. Now, this gets to the heart of the story, which is just how massively fucked Syria is at the moment and how fucked it's been pretty much since the beginning of this civil war. They say, okay, well, al-Qaeda and jihadists have Shia civilians under lockdown, and naturally they're treating them brutally in certain parts of Syria. And in other parts of Syria, Assad and Hezbollah and the Shia government and alliance have Sunni civilians, and they're being treated brutally in that area. And they're trying to broker a deal where they trade civilians, but apparently to this point, the deal has fallen through, so these people live in these hellish circumstances on both sides. You have people under al-Qaeda control, naturally, not being treated right if you're Shia. In fact, I'm surprised they haven't just mass-executed them, and other times they have mass-executed them, but the remaining ones. And vice versa for how the Shias are apparently treating the Sunnis in this case. So it's a heartbreaking and terrible scenario. And, you know, I have to say, man, you guys know me. I'm a non-interventionist, and I'm fairly committed to that. So I only want to use our military in self-defense to protect the country. I get it if we want to use the UN and unilaterally stop, like, a genocide, for example. But civil wars, by and large, I want to stay out because it's a civil war. You know, what are you going to do? Pick sides in a fight that has nothing to do with you? That's like you see a bar fight at the end of the bar from two people you never met before. You're like, yeah, let me jump in and help guy X. You don't fucking know that guy. What are you talking about? That doesn't make sense. That makes no sense. So, but in this case, with the pictures coming out of there and whatnot, I'm not for a military intervention. But if I was the UN, would I try to fly by and drop, you know, goods and food and whatever, medical products for these people? Oh, absolutely. Now, don't get me wrong. I know it's difficult because you don't know, you know, what kind of abilities they have and who would be a danger to you. Would the Syrian forces be a danger to you? Would Hezbollah be a danger to you? Would, you know, ISIS and al-Qaeda, who are also in Syria in different areas, are they going to be a danger to you? Well, yeah, we've seen a massive increase in execution of aid workers and journalists recently from that side. So I know it's a hard thing, and maybe I'm just, you know, being too idealistic and naive here, but what are you going to do? Let people starve? Is that what you're going to do? And see, this is an example of a time where it's not like the best use of Western power or international power is let's send somebody in there with a gun and kill people and possibly even kill civilians. No, oftentimes that breeds more resentment, and oftentimes, like I said, you're intervening in a situation that's complicated and you have no right or shouldn't intervene in it. But this is a time where the UN and the international community, if they dropped food, I would absolutely support it. You know, that kind of aid and that kind of, you know, money spent for something like that is something that I would absolutely support. Now, understand, though, as well, there's a lot of propaganda that comes out of Syria today, and it really is hard to get valid information. But in this case, I feel comfortable reporting this to you because they have vice reporters on the ground there, so I'm much more inclined to believe it. But always be skeptical when reading almost anything about Syria today, because there's this new trick that a lot of groups do where they take a name that sounds like a legit international human rights group, and they name themselves that, but then when you dig deeper, you find out they're indeed not a human rights group. And in the case of Syria, they're almost always massively biased in favor of the rebels to the point where they paint a rosy picture of Islamist rebels and sometimes jihadist rebels. So you have to be careful with where you get your information from, and one of the key ones to look out for is the UK-based Syrian Observatory for Human Rights. Red flag on any information that comes from them. But in this case, since it's reported by Vice, and they have people on the ground, I feel comfortable reporting it to you. So it's a gross situation, and it's a reminder that in the year 2016, we're still seeing stuff like this, and whether it's here in Syria or it's in North Korea with their literally Nazi-like conditions. Evil exists in the world, and we should be aware. Okay. Next. Fox News is going to go into defense mode here over the armed right-wing patriot group that took over a government building in Oregon. So let's watch, but take note of how they talk about black protesters in Missouri versus these guys.
They raise a question, Janine, of the racial tensions that we've seen in Missouri and the fact that in those situations when people are rising up in that case against the police and against that government institution, that they are always referred to as being a group of black people, a group of sometimes thugs, those kind of names are used. And they say, you know, in this case, why aren't people talking about the fact that this is a group of white militiamen? Why is that distinction not made?
Well, listen, what happened in Missouri is really outrageous because you had individuals who were very destructive. They destroyed property. They destroyed their communities. We're looking at Oregon. Right now, these individuals are being peaceful. They're outraged about the overgrowth of government. It's government going wild. And I tell you, we don't want to see this happen across the country, but this is an example of something that can happen because of the overgrowth of government. And Americans are tired of government intrusion in their everyday lives. And so these individuals right now are peaceful. They want to rein in government going wild. Why is it that the federal government owns 47% of Western states in our country? In Oregon alone, the federal government owns 53% of the property. So it's really outrageous how government is creeping into our everyday lives, no matter what it is you're doing. And people just want to be left alone.
Jessica, they're revolting against that.
Okay. This is a case study in Fox News hypocrisy. They're not thugs. They're fighting the overgrowth of government. Oh, I see. Whereas when black protesters are saying, hey, could you not kill us when we're unarmed? When they say that to the police officers, that's not fighting the overgrowth of government. You know, a government that literally kills you, shoots you in the face if you're unarmed. That's not fighting the overgrowth of government. They're thugs. What are you going to do? I mean, obviously, if you're in the black community and you keep getting gunned down when you're unarmed, just take it. And if you fight back and if you protest and if you say, hey, this is the tyranny of the government here that we should be concerned about, you can't say that. But when it comes to white militiamen, and they're like, we have a dispute over an arson case when this guy burned down hundreds of acres of government land. Overgrowth of government to give them a prison sentence. In that case, oh, yes, overgrowth of government. Now, understand, I'm actually consistent on this. So I'm against police officers shooting unarmed civilians, and I'm on the side of the protesters in those circumstances. And like I said, I sympathize with these guys who got a mandatory minimum of 5 years for doing arson and burning down their own property, but also getting some of the government's property in the process. They had just burned their own property, it wouldn't have been a crime. They burned the government property, they say by accident, and now they have to spend 5 years in jail. Yeah, the mandatory minimum is the problem. We can fight against that. But see, I'm consistent, and when I look at protesters who are fighting against police abuse and that kind of bad big government, I'm also against that. These guys are like, no, when the black people do it, bad, thugs, not okay. When the white people do it, oh, they're constitutionalists, and they're principled, and they're fighting the overreach of government. But wait a second, let's be consistent here. You didn't say that when the black protesters were fighting the overreach of government, of police officers who were gunning them down. So it's just, their bias is so apparent. And don't make me laugh when you say it's peaceful. Okay, peaceful is not taking guns, going into a government building, and holding the territory at the barrel of a gun. They're holding 600 acres at the barrel of a gun. That's not peaceful. If the Crips or the Bloods or a Muslim group or anybody else did that, we'd be saying this is that action in and of itself is violent. So by their logic, what? Any white militia can go into any government building and take it over at the barrel of a gun, and it's peaceful. Why? I don't know. They didn't do the specific kind of violence that some protesters did when it was in Missouri, so I guess it's peaceful? No, but that's not true. And also, let's be clear, I was totally against, and I did segments against, any looting that happened from protests in Missouri and elsewhere. But I'm against violence across the board. It's called consistency. So I'm in favor of peaceful protests in the case of police abuse. I'm in favor of peaceful protests in the case of what happened here. But this indeed is not a peaceful protest. Let's call it what it is. This is an armed takeover of a government building, but Fox News is okay with it because they're white. If they were black, they would not be. Okay, let me take a quick break, and then when we come back, Ben Carson gives one of the weirdest interviews I've ever seen, and then we got some Christian fundamentalists who, man, they really, really, really get weird in this segment. I mean, the stuff that they argue for and that they proudly argue for is, it makes you run into the arms of atheists and secularists, so I really should be thanking them because they're doing more good for our movement than anybody. All right, stay right there.
Thank you.
son of a bitch. All right, we're back. And Ben Carson is about to flex his weirdness yet again for you. All right. Ben Carson gave one of the weirdest interviews I've ever seen to Jake Tapper of CNN. Let's watch a piece of it here.
The former campaign manager said that an interview Dr. Carson did with Sally Quinn, in which he said that he doesn't believe in the rapture or hell, I believe, was damaging. That's what the former campaign manager said. Do you think it was damaging? And what do the religious voters out there need to know about Dr. Carson?
Well, first, I think we need to correct the false narratives about Dr. Carson. Every time he's labeled as such, and we discover later that that's not truly the case. Dr. Carson is a man who believes in the divinity of Jesus Christ. He's a man who believes in mainstream doctrine. And as far as I'm concerned and he's concerned, we want to major on the majors. Clearly, there's lots of different denominations. There shouldn't be divisiveness within the body of Christ, and there's room for latitude in many areas. So I think Dr. Carson's a wonderful man of faith.
And just to add on to that, you know, a lot of times when people say things, they take them completely out of context. So, you know, they come and they say, I don't believe in a rapture. I don't believe in a secret rapture where people just, he's sitting here one minute and he disappears. I believe in what the Bible says in the book Thessalonians, where he will come. Everybody will see him. People will be raised from the dead, caught up. You know, I believe what the Bible says.
Oh, my God, it's so sad to listen to this. Guys, the year's 2016. What are you doing? What are you doing? Look at how that starts out. You know, this is Jake Tapper. He said that he doesn't believe in the rapture or hell. And Carson and his spokesman are like, yes, he does. Yes, he does. You're not going to get us on this one. Yeah, he does believe in the rapture. He does believe in the Bible. What? Oh, my God. Oh, my God. That's so sad. I can't believe I'm watching this. I actively want to hide this video clip from all of our friends in Europe, all of our friends in Australia, all of our friends in Canada. Because they see this and they're like, oh, sweet Jesus, what has American politics come to? What has it come to? Listen to what they just said. Listen to what they just said. They say you don't believe in the rapture. Yes, I do. No, what I said is I don't believe in a secret rapture where poof, you just disappear. No, I believe in the grand rapture, the way it's described in the Bible, where God comes back and you see him and he raises people from the dead. And by the way, finish that thought there, Ben. What happens next? You do know that God basically kills almost all the Jews. So what are you saying, Ben? Are you in favor of another Holocaust? Because you say, I believe in the rapture, I think it's going to happen. You're a Christian, so you believe in this theology. You say you do. I'm not saying you do. You say you do. So is that what you're in favor of? No, but see, this is why we need to, across the board here, when it comes to Christianity, when it comes to Islam, when it comes to all the religions, this is why we have to be open and honest about all the facts and about what the doctrines say, so we can have a discussion about just how fucking crazy it is! As a general rule, 50% of the holy books are madness, are scientifically not correct, or out-and-out barbaric, okay? So you can't defend it, and if you say you actually believe in it, well, then I'm going to ask you to defend it. And what happens, it starts to look like you're watching a fucking Monty Python skit. I mean, look at it. They say you don't believe in the rapture. Oh, yeah, I do. I don't believe in the secret rapture. I believe in the rapture the way it says in the Bible, how God's going to come back and kill everybody. Oh, my God. Oh, my God, you have to stop. You have to wake up from your fairy tales. This is myths. This is voodoo. This is, you might as well be reading Mother Goose or a Dr. Seuss book or, you know, fucking Harry Potter or something like that. And he's saying it desperately. For those of you who don't know, there's stuff going on behind the scenes for Ben Carson. So his top campaign guy just left, and somebody else who was a top official to his campaign left. And so people are saying, well, it's because he's a shitty fucking candidate, and he's stubborn and all these different things. And he's like, no, I'm going to hire. So he hires new guys, apparently, and they're having this conversation. And apparently one of the guys said behind the scenes, hey, I'm leaving because he said he doesn't believe in the rapture. He has a merry band of idiots trying to get him elected president. No wonder why he's out there saying shit like, China's in Syria. He said that during the debate. Totally made up. No wonder he can't name a single country that would be in our anti-ISIS coalition with us. All you got to do is name any country in the Middle East. Any country. He's like, I think all the Arab and non-Arab states are going to be with us. Name one. He couldn't do it because he doesn't know anything. So this is who you have running for president, and he briefly led. Fucking briefly led. He can't name anybody to help us fight ISIS. He doesn't know what's going on with foreign policy. He definitely doesn't know anything about domestic policy either. And his whole message is, I do believe in the Bible. I do believe in the rapture. Not only is that stupid because it's stupid, it's also stupid from a politics perspective. Because, dude, what are you doing? You're going to get maximum 25% to 40% of the population on your side. Maximum. Because those are the crazy evangelical fundamentalist or conservative Christians, 25 to 40% of the country. But 60% of the country is going to go, I'm writing this dude off. Are you serious? Seriously? The rapture is... He's like, that's my strategy. This is what's going to work. This is what I'm going to go with. And this is what I believe. It's like we have children running for president. We have a reality TV show star who says he's a successful businessman, but he went bankrupt 4 times. That guy's leading. And then we got this guy who's hanging in there still. He was briefly leading, and then he was number 2. Now he's dropping. But Rapture Boy over here is like, yeah, I believe in it. I believe in the Bible. Vote for me. Bible. Running on Christian theocracy. And the other guys ain't so good either. Getting ugly. I got more crazy Christians. Let's go to Rick Wiles. Rick Wiles is a Christian fundamentalist and a right-wing radio host, and he went on Jim Baker's televangelism show. By the way, this guy is a convicted criminal. He's a fraud. He's a charlatan. Somehow, you know, when he's done serving his time, he gets out. He's like, well, I'm going to go right back doing the same shit. And he does. So he goes on this televangelism show to really be anti-America. People, like, tar me with that, like I'm against America. No, I love America, and that's why I criticize it, because I actually want to bring us back to sanity and rationality and get us to a point where we abide by the Constitution and we make smart decisions. This guy, you get the sense he doesn't even do that. He's just flat out bashing the U.S. and saying Russia is better and kind of rooting for an attack on the U.S. You don't believe me? Let's listen.
The Soviet Union was the world power for evil, for trouble, starting wars, toppling nations. It was an atheistic, God-hating nation. The Christians there had to go underground.
Right.
America was the shining nation in the 50s and 60s and 70s. We stood for what was right.
Yes.
It is completely flipped upside down.
Yes.
I never thought I would say this. I never thought there would be a day that I would be saying, God bless Russia.
Oh. Wow.
God bless Russia.
Well, it's illegal to say God bless America in school.
Yeah. Well, they don't want you to say God bless America. So God's saying, well, I'm going to move over to another country right now where the people want to bless me. All right. We were talking about pornography earlier.
Yeah.
You know, Russia passed a law in 2015 that banned all Internet pornography.
Yeah.
Russia passed a law that banned homosexual pride parades for 100 years. Russia passed a law that bans gay propaganda to children. What's going on, Jim? Russia is turning to God. America has walked away from God.
My.
America is losing her leadership in the world, and Russia is becoming the leader of the world. And if we don't understand it in those contexts, we're going to keep talking about, you know, bad Russia. You know, they got to be attacked. They got to be brought down. No, you don't understand it. God may use Russia to attack evil America.
Oh, man, precious. And these are the guys who typically tar the left with being anti-America. He just said God may use Russia to attack the evil United States. Ooh, so you think there's going to be a divine war, a holy war against the U.S. that you'd support? Sounds to me like you're kind of interested in a jihad of sorts. See, when I go after U.S. policy, I do it because I want to make the country better. I do it because I want us to actually abide by many of the founding principles of the country, for example. I care about freedom. I care about democracy. I care about free speech. I care about not being an imperialist nation and all this stuff. It's constructive criticism. This guy's like, yeah, you know, God, we got to worship God. We got to be a Christian theocracy. And if we're not, perhaps God will use evil, not evil Russia, Russia to attack the evil United States. No, 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 no. He's diagnosed the situation exactly wrong. But this shows you how fundamentalist religion just perverts your mind in so many ways. I mean, listen to the arguments that he made. He said Russia is now a godly nation because they banned porn. Only a mind that has drunk the Kool-Aid of fundamentalist religion can believe that. Pornography, which various studies have shown, it helps you relieve stress, is a net positive effect overall, because you have a society that's not repressed and angry and wound up in so many ways. And of course, masturbation has also been proven to be positive and healthy for people. He goes, well, no, I don't care about the data, about the facts, about the science on how that stuff is good for you and how it's normal and how it's quite literally one of the most natural things a person can do. Forget that. God, no touchy-touchy, no hanky-panky, no pornography. And even the people in the crowd are like, yeah. Oh, come on. All of you are fucking hypocrites. Everybody in that crowd has gone to work on themselves within the past week, I bet. Probably that same day if we're talking about the dudes. So I don't believe them when they say that stuff in terms of what they actually feel is right, but they try to hold themselves to this ridiculous standard, which I don't even think that's in the Bible. And then also you have Russia bans homosexuality and gay pride parades, and that's what makes them godly. That's your main takeaway from Christianity? Now, to be clear, that actually is in Christianity. You're supposed to stone gay people to death, or it's in the Bible, so they have some theological backing for that one. But notice how they always conveniently ignore the good parts. The same thing happens with Muslim fundamentalists, too. They'll look at the bad parts, and they'll live their life by it, and they'll try to abide by it, and they'll think it's literally true. But then they contradict themselves, and they don't do any of the good parts. You know, like, for the ones who are, or actually this isn't necessarily a good part, but it's not as bad. For the Muslim fundamentalists who are beheading Christians and Jews, in the Quran, you're not supposed to do that. In Islam, you're not supposed to do that. They make the, for the pagans and the infidels, you are, according to some interpretation, so it's still bad. But you're not supposed to do that with them, but they do it anyway, and then they claim, no, we're being the most Muslim. That's like these guys saying, no, it's the most Christian to just want to ban homosexuality. But wait a second, what about all the parts of the Bible you ignore? All the, treat your neighbor good, care about the refugees and the immigrants, be anti-rich and help the poor and all that stuff. Ignore all that stuff, and they only care about it when it's the bad parts of the Bible. No, see, it's this kind of thinking and this kind of religious lunacy that represents a threat to government in the United States, because these yokels are the kind of people who get elected in Midwestern and Southern states to state governments and local governments, and they make decisions there. That's why there was a story recently about somebody who got fired because they wouldn't participate in prayer meetings. A government official! A government official! So, these guys are a problem, man. And they're telling you right there, they're laying it out for you. These are our plans, this is our goal, and boy, isn't Russia so much better than the United States of America today. No, they're not, and you have a perverse view of the world. Okay. Now, I got to go to Erdogan and go after this fool. Turkish President Tayyip Erdogan is continuing to prove that he is a profoundly dangerous buffoon on the world stage. The New York Times is reporting that in comments broadcast by Turkish media on Friday, Erdogan made some really disturbing comments. Quote, Erdogan wants to change the Turkish constitution to turn the ceremonial role of president into that of a chief executive, a Turkish version of the system in the United States, France, or Russia. Asked on his return from a visit to Saudi Arabia late on Thursday whether an executive presidential system was possible while maintaining the unitary structure of the state, he said, quote, there are already examples in the world. You can see it when you look at Hitler's Germany. Whoa, 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 whoa. Wait, what? So you're like, wait, so you're trying to give yourself more power as a unitary executive. Okay, is it possible for, you know, Turkey to be as successful if they have that kind of a government? He's like, totally. Look at Nazi Germany. Perfect example. That's wrong in so many ways. First of all, by what metric, by what standard was Nazi Germany successful? I believe none. It was a horrific, viciously intolerant, racist, bigoted system built on genocide, the Holocaust, oppression, war, militarism. And naturally, it failed spectacularly. He's like, that's my idea of success. But even if you interpret this as kindly as possible, what he means is, I would like to have as much power as the unitary executive did in Germany, Hitler. I would like to have that much power. That's still not a good thing. No, nobody should have that much power. Look at what he did with that power. Absolute power corrupts absolutely. But even if, let's say, okay, so he just wants that much power, he doesn't mean, oh, the Holocaust and whatnot. That's still stupid. Because what you're doing is you're destroying a rich history and tradition in Turkey of a secular democracy. And that's the problem with Erdogan, period, is that he's a Muslim fundamentalist. He is a power-hungry dictator and tyrant, and he's ruining the tradition of Ataturk and the tradition of having democracy and secularism in Turkey, and he's doing it with a smile on his face. He's basically doing the same trick that Vladimir Putin does in Russia, where he's prime minister, and he makes all the decisions, because that's what the prime minister is supposed to do in Turkey. Or that's not fair. He has the most power. The prime minister is supposed to have the most power. And then when he's out of time there, he goes to become president, and he spends time there, and he'll just keep going back and forth. And he's trying to do constitutional changes and structural governmental changes to give him more power and allow it so that he can just have more power and he doesn't have to go back and forth. And there's evidence of him stealing elections and whatnot and viciously cracking down on the Kurds and cracking down on anybody who disagrees with him, locking up a kid for comparing him to Gollum in a Facebook post, a Lord of the Rings character or whatever. People put up one person tore down, this one was a kid too, tore down the poster of Erdogan somewhere. He's in a jail cell now. This guy is a brutal, authoritarian, backwards buffoon. And again, other things too, like you think, okay, it's just, it's regional though, it's contained. It ain't contained, bitch. Look at what he did with Russia. He says, I don't believe him, the Russian plane flew into Turkish airspace. Shoot it down. There were no warnings, no nothing. They lied and were like, we gave like over 20 warnings. Nonsense! Shot down a Russian plane. This is the kind of epic moron that blunders our way into World War III. And now you know what he's all about. He's like, okay, an example of a successful government that's basically a fascist dictatorship. Hitler's Germany. That's what I want to be like. Yeah, yeah. Who says that? Who says that? A stupid person says that. A barbaric person says that. A moron says that. But one of our allies, so shh, don't talk about Turkey as if it's run by a fundamentalist Muslim crazy person. Shh, can't talk about that, just like you can't talk about how Saudi is a Salafi terror state that has the same ideology as ISIS. Shh, don't talk about that. They're our allies. They're our friends. So only Iran, only talk about Iran being bad. That's the only one you have a green light to talk about being bad. Everybody else, www.shh.com, and let's move along. I'm not going to move along. Stuff like this should not go by without us recognizing it and doing something policy-wise. How about we slowly untangle relations with countries that, I don't know, behead sorcerers and behead people for witchcraft and kill people for apostasy? And we slowly untangle our relationship with the country with the guy who idolizes Adolf Hitler and Nazi Germany. Or am I asking too much? I don't know. Yeah, and I'd also like to slowly back off of the country that's very fond of occupying people, too. Oh, I know you're not allowed to say that one, but I just said it. All right, next. A former cop of the year in Texas was exposed as a member of Mexico's toughest drug cartel. This is an unbelievable story. Free Thought Project reports on this, quote, a former officer of the year has been accused of secretly working for Los Zetas cartel in a drug trafficking conspiracy in operation since 2006. The nephew of Houston police officer Noe Juarez, or perhaps that's supposed to say Noel, but it's cut off, though I'm not sure, was sentenced to 33 years in federal prison after caught smuggling 1,640 kilograms of cocaine throughout the southern states and East Coast. His brother was later charged along with Officer Juarez for participating in a conspiracy to distribute 5 or more kilograms of cocaine. Juarez was also charged in a separate conspiracy to possess firearms in furtherance of a drug trafficking crime. According to newly released court documents, they also provided the cartel with firearms, pepper spray, bulletproof vests, luxury vehicles, police scanner radios, and sensitive information to Los Zetas cartel members. Okay, that's unreal. So I need everybody to understand completely what's happening here. It's not like it was a tentative loose connection every once in a while. Something happens where you needed a little bit of this, a little bit of that, and there's some sort of connection there. No, the dude was like part of the cartel. Like he was somebody who it was a cop of the year in Texas, and he's working with them all the time and giving them all these different things, police scanners, luxury vehicles, pepper spray, bulletproof vests, guns, all this stuff. And I bet you there are many people who hear this story and they're like, duh. Now, maybe us on the outside are naive. I mean, look, I follow corruption in U.S. politics all the time. But this is an extra level of corruption where some would say, hey, come on, man, you're bordering on conspiracy theory there. Is it conspiracy theory? I admittedly don't know much about the arguments with the CIA and how the CIA was intricately involved with the drug trade and they were selling it and pushing it and it was purposely to hurt black communities and all that stuff. I don't know the details of that. Is it true? Maybe. But when I read stuff like this, I go, yeah, there's a decent chance it is true. Why? Because you don't need a formal conspiracy when like interests converge. This is something that I actually think George Carlin pointed it out, where he says, you don't need a smoke-filled back room when it's people who, hey, you know, I'm a cop in this place and I don't make all that much money and I'd like to make more money and I don't have any moral qualms against drugs. I think drugs are fine. I drink alcohol, whatever, and they get involved. The next thing you know, they're like a top official working with a barbaric drug cartel. You know, there's an easy way to stop this. Legalize, tax, and regulate drugs. If you don't do that, what's going to happen? There's going to be a monopoly on the drug market from the cartels. So the people who are doing the crime are the people who are going to get all the money and all of the power. if you legalize, tax, and regulate, what's going to happen? CVS and Walgreens and this liquor store at the corner and this supermarket brand and Jack Daniels and everybody else, all the corporations and all normal people who are not beheading people in rural parts of Mexico as part of a drug cartel, they're going to start selling the drugs. And it's going to be part of the economy, and it's going to be safer because it's regulated, and it's going to bring us revenue because it's taxed, and you can do education programs about the drugs, and you can fund rehabilitation centers so when people really have a problem, they get help. But if we just keep it banned like it is right now, it's just going to keep getting worse and worse. Prohibition is the perfect example of this. That's what made the mafia powerful, because you banned alcohol. When you made it legal and you taxed it and you regulated it, the mafia gets much less powerful because they don't have a monopoly anymore. So people don't want to go to them. They want to go to official businesses. That's how you put the cartels out of business. And that's how you stop a situation where our officers are working with vicious drug cartels. So in this case, look, I don't know all the details of what he participated in, but obviously he should be brought to justice like anybody else in a situation like this. But the long-term strategy to clean up this entire situation, legalize, tax, and regulate. All right, more. A Scottish man working as a miner in Kyrgyzstan is being deported after posting a joke on Facebook. Michael McFeet posted a picture of the national dish of Kyrgyzstan, which is some kind of sausage. And he said, quote, "The Kyrgyz people queuing out of the door for their special delicacy, the horse penis." So this led to outrage in the country. According to BBC News, Radio Azatik said, quote, "Mr. McFeet's post had caused a lot of discontent and resentment on the part of local staff who demanded respect for the traditions of the people of Kyrgyzstan, as well as an apology from the mines management company. He faced up to 5 years in prison," oh my God, "under Kyrgyzstan's race hate laws." Oh, goodness. So get this. Instead, they said, let's deport him. So they arrested him, deported him, and then they turned around and said, oh, the deportation? No, that had nothing to do with the joke. They just deported him. Oh, stop it. Just stop it, stop it, stop it. Every aspect of this story annoys me. Except the joke, obviously. Like, guys, no, this is embarrassing, and this is silly, and this is why you're mocked. You know how you're supposed to react if the dish that looks like a horse dick is made fun of? Here's how you react. He said horse dick. All right, next, let's do something else here. So what do? They get all the, I'm offended, and that's racist. Under race hate laws, he might be sent out. So making a joke about a horse dick is a race hate law? That's our national dish. And I'm fine with making fun of everybody's national dish, if indeed it is funny. If yours happens to look like a horse dick, sucks for you. I'm going to make fun of it. But people, you know what it is? It's pride that gets in the way, and it's people thinking they have a right not to be offended and thinking that they're special. No, people should be allowed to joke about anything, anything. Now, don't get me wrong. Sometimes are there jokes that are not tasteful? Sure. And are you allowed to say that? Sure. But in terms of trying to take legal action or deporting somebody because your feelings got hurt, no, no, no. Fuck you if you do that. See, the thing is, you're the bad guy. They'd never admit that, and they don't even know that. But if you're part of the joke outrage crowd, either here in Kyrgyzstan or in the U.S. or anywhere, if you're in the joke outrage crowd, your priorities are fucked up, and you're the bigger problem. Because your main goal is censorship and shutting down and, you know, being part of the metaphorical lynch mob when somebody says anything you slightly disagree with or is kind of funny. So get over it. You know, you're the bigger problem here. People should be allowed to make jokes, and this goes for everywhere and everyone. Okay, out of time, guys. I love you. We'll see you tomorrow. Peace. Mwah.